Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Travel Department. Discover hundreds of unforgettable destinations with expert local guides.
But first, on Tuesday in the Central Criminal Court, a teenage boy was sentenced to 10 years detention with the final 2 years suspended for attempted murder. The victim of the stabbing attack was Defence Forces Chaplain Father Paul Murphy. The attack was random. The boy, who was exposed to radical Islamist ideology online, wanted to attack a member of the Defence Forces, and Father Paul was the one he encountered. At the court proceedings earlier in April, Father Murphy did an extraordinary thing. He hugged the boy and told him that he forgave him. Father Paul Murphy joined me in studio just after the sentence was handed down by Mr Justice Paul McDermott. And I began by asking him about his background first and where he grew up.
I grew up in Waterford City. We're old Waterford stock. Lived opposite the park. The People's Park was our front garden. So mum and dad and four brothers and one sister. So we lived there for a number of years, and I went to seminary, and my parents then moved out onto the Dunmore Road beyond the regional hospital, the university hospital now. So we had a great time there. School was across the road, St Eccles De La Salle Primary School, and then De La Salle College across the road from that again. So I had about, 30 seconds it took me to get to school in the morning. I was probably still late half of the time, but it was a really nice place and a beautiful area of the city. And you'd miss some of that, the bandstand in the park where the bands were playing in the mornings and that on a Sunday morning. And, the kids going in for the playground and that kind of thing, bicycle races and so on. So it's a bit different now, but it's happy memories.
And your mum's still in Waterford?
Mum is still in Waterford. She is. She's doing great. She lives out, as I say, on the Dunmore Road. Still goes into Mass every morning and up to Dad's grave and so on in Ballygunner. And she really loves it there where she is in that place. And everything is so handy to her there, So it's good for her, yeah.
Proud of her son?
Proud of all of her children, I'm sure. So we've all, done well in our own ways, thank God. And she's proud of all of them, yeah.
Why did you decide to become a priest?
So you're starting with the easier questions. I suppose I was involved in our local parish at the time, which was St John's in Waterford. And in one sense, I grew into it. I was an altar server and I used to help with the altar servers then and set up a folk group and, we had youth groups and pioneer groups and so many other things. And it was almost a natural progression to go on to seminary and see. And, at that time we had a seminary in Waterford, which was St John's College. And Bishop Russell, God rest him, took me on and he said, if I let you into St John's now, you'll be going home every day. And I said, I won't. So he said, right, you can go to St John's. And I spent 6 happy years there in St John's, did our philosophy and our theology. And, we had various pastoral placements in different things around in the city, projects and so on. I'm involved in the Order of Malta as well since I was 11 years of age. And I was allowed to continue my involvement there and first aid and ambulance work and, teaching first aid and that kind of thing. So it suited me well to be there. And I did get to go home maybe on a Sunday for a bite of food or for the laundry to be done.
And when did you get assigned to the Defence Forces?
So I worked in various parishes. I started off as a deacon in St. Paul's Parish in Waterford, and I was in Folsom Parish in California. Came back, was ordained a priest, was sent then to Clonmel, St. Peter and Paul's Parish in Clonmel. Very happy 5 years there. Back to what had become my mother's parish and dad's parish in the meantime. So they had 7 years of putting up with me in front of them when they went to Mass every day. And then I went to a parish of Dunhill and Fenner, just west of Tramore. And I had 5.5 years there. But all along, the Defence Forces had asked me, would I be happy to join? And my bishop at the time, God rest him, wasn't so keen on the idea of losing a priest, to the diocese. So it took about 13 years before there was an agreement for me to go to the Defence Forces. And the place that was vacant at the time was Dún Laoghaire, Renmore Barracks in Galway. So I was happy to get to Galway and to be able to, just carve out a new space for myself there, participate fully in what's going on. And I've been there now for over 11 years.
And have you gone abroad with the Defence Forces?
I have, yeah, many times. So I've had this, I'm going on my 6th tour of duty. I've had 3 tours in the UNDOF mission in Syria, and I've had 2 full tours in the UNIFIL mission in Lebanon. And I've done a few kind of covers as well for 3 or 4 weeks at a time in those places. So I'm due to go back to Lebanon now next month. We have a whole battalion which is led by Lieutenant Colonel McDonough, former commander in Galway. And we have a lot of our Galway troops going, as well as others from all over the country. So I'm happy to be part of that, going with them back to that area again.
When you are a chaplain to the Defence Forces, what does that entail? Is it like normal work within a parish? What happens?
Well, it's very different. I mean, our focus is just on a certain cohort of people, which is, you know, the numbers that you have in the Defence Forces. Now, there's a lot of fluidity, people coming and going the whole time. So people say, how many are in your barracks? And it changes every day because there are courses, there are various different assignments and deployments and so on. But you know, I was a school chaplain. I mean, in where I had gone to school in De La Salle, I ended up back there as a chaplain for another 9 years. And I had been a chaplain in the high school in Clonmel and various other places and primary schools as well. And I mean, my view of chaplaincy is that I loiter with intent.
I love it.
And, you know, it's just to be there for people. And, you know, I've had some great experiences over the years of guys coming to me and saying, you know, just thank you for just being there. You know, it made a difference when I came into school in the morning, just that you were there. So that loitering with intent is important to me. Not with any major big agenda, except to be there for people who might, you know, be happy to have you there.
That's a beautiful way of putting it, actually. If you don't mind, I'm going to bring you back to the 15th of August, 2024. What happened?
15th of August 2024 was a holy day, the Feast of Our Lady. So we had Mass in the morning. In fact, actually, my mam had been there and my brother and his wife had brought her to Galway just for the second time in 11 years. They had spent 2 nights and we had, you know, great fun and so on and went to the theatre and so on. So after Mass that morning, we went and had some brunch and then they made their way home. I went to a funeral that evening, a funeral house. Came back to the barracks and it was that bit of a quieter day. So I was able to change and, you know, prepare for my swim. I try and get up to the pool for a swim every evening just to...
That's why you look so well.
Well, it's to get some time out of the barracks, really, because, you know, there are days that I might not just leave the barracks at all without that. So it's just a bit of normality and a bit of, you know, talk with people who are not in barracks, not in the army. So I went up for a swim and, you know, there were so many blessings on that night. I mean, obviously, you know, the reason we're here is because somebody tried to kill me. But apart from the fact that somebody came to kill another person, everything was blessed on that night. So, for example, I was late coming home from the pool. Normally, it's a routine. I'm out of the pool at 10, shower, change, into the car, back home. But that night, one of the staff in the pool had announced her retirement. I was talking with her and the staff. And then I spoke with another couple out in the car park. So I was maybe 15 minutes later getting home, got down to the gate of the barracks. You know, there's a procedure entering any military installation where you would dim your headlights so that they can identify who you are, put on the light inside in the car. And I had done that and somebody approached my window, my driver's side window, and I put down the window. And, you know, when you press the button, it's automatic nowadays and it goes all the way down. And for some reason, my window didn't open fully on that night. It opened 2/3 of the way. And if it had opened the full way, I would be dead. And, you know, it was, I mean, I had a certain protection in my car. I was able to take my foot off the brake and the car started up again. It was an automatic car and it started moving towards the gate. And then it became an option for me to drive through the gate to try to get away from this person who was stabbing me. So I was able to, you know, crash through the gates of the barracks. But he kept coming with me all the way into the barracks and kept trying to stab me with a knife. You know, most of that is on video, on CCTV, until we got right into the depth of the barracks. And, you know, I believe there were maybe 20 deliberate attempts on my life in the bit that's on video. Now, I remember it vividly, all the small little bits and pieces. Whereas when, you know, when you look at the CCTV, it's all very quick. You know, it's over in 90 seconds or something. But I remember all the detail of it. And while I didn't remember his face, I do remember the determination on his face and the real intent to, you know, to put an end to my life.
Did you think in that moment that you might lose your life?
I hadn't much time to think at all. But I had, you know, I had time to think that this was serious. I had time to turn and face out that side. And the idea was to get my head in to the centre of the car, away from him. So my two arms were facing him, and that's how I got stabbed on both arms. It was an 8-inch blade, a serrated bayonet hunting type knife. I knew not to grab that because it would take my fingers off. But I was able to grab his wrists in the hope of holding on to him. But he had the advantage of being outside, standing up and being able to pull away from the window of the car. So we did that. But in the process, as we went along, you know, I was stabbed. We got into, you know, the final place where the car stopped. I opened the door to try to push him away. And of course, he pushed it back in again and tried stabbing me again. Then I was able to get my 2 feet onto the door and push it out, and that pushed him back. But of course, when he came back to me again, it was to an open door. I got my 2 feet onto his chest, pushed him back. And I think I did that a second time. I can't testify to that, but I think a second time. And in the meantime, you know, the soldiers who were on duty had seen what was going on, called stand to. Everybody came to attention, got their weapons and so on. They came out, shouted verbal warnings, fired warning shots. And one of our brave soldiers then was able to take him down to the ground. And, you know, there were four or five jumped on top of him and restrained him there.
It was a totally random attack, wasn't it, Father? So do you think of yourself as very unlucky that you were the person that was attacked?
No, you know, that was part of the commentary afterwards. I mean, this news went around the world, to Canada, America, South America, Australia, India, you know, messages came to me from all these places. And, you know, the general consensus was that I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, I would dispute that, and I would say that that wasn't the case at all. In my view, I was the right person in the right place at the right time. And the fact is that, you know, that boy had come to kill a soldier. That's a matter of record now. He'd come to kill a soldier, and I thank God every day that it was me that he got to rather than one of the others. You know, we've a lot of young soldiers there. They come and go walking, you know, walking out the gate, walking in the gate and so on. I had a certain protection in my car, as I say. I'm of a certain age now, and I have worked with the Order of Malta, as I said, for over 40 years. I've been a priest for almost 30 years. I've been in the army for 11 years. And I just felt that I was in a position where I could contextualise what happened in a way that would be much more difficult for somebody who was a young soldier, male or female, starting out in life. You know, we had a young female soldier on the gate that night, half my size, and she, you know, did a super job. But, you know, it would have been a much different story if somebody had walked out and had been confronted by that knife.
But you know how generous that sounds of you, that you are glad it was you rather than someone else. I mean, you practice incredibly, this incredibly in kind approach to people and to life.
Well, you know, like, the army is a family, and, you know, I live there. I live in the barracks, and the troops live there too, and we're all part of a family. And, you know, to me, you have children yourself. Mm. You know, if something were to happen to one of your kids, you would willingly put yourself in their place. And that's all I did too. I was just happy that it was me and not one of them. And, you know, people said to me afterwards, like, are you not mad? Are you not angry about this? No, anger will only hurt me. It won't hurt anybody else. You know, it does nothing else. So to me, like, I just see the blessings in it. There were so many other things that, even from a security point of view, I can't really talk about. But so many things that were really good on that night. And, you know, to me, if one of the others had been injured or probably killed, then I'd be mad. Mm. You know, then I'd have a different outlook on it. But the fact that it's me, I was able to just, you know, contextualize it, as I say, into my life. And, you know, even from the religious perspective, that was Our Lady's Day, Our Lady's Feast Day, the day that Our Lady was assumed into heaven. Our Lady got into heaven. They weren't ready for me that night. It was also the vigil of the anniversary of Father Willie Doyle, who was an Irish army chaplain, an Irish man who was an army chaplain with the British Army, killed in the First World War. And, you know, he showed great heroism and so on, and sanctity. And at the moment, they're investigating whether Father Doyle should be considered a saint. So we had been promoting that in our church, which was just 100 metres from where this happened. You know, we had issued prayer cards and so on. Our Lady of the Rosary is the patroness of the Defence Forces. My rosary beads was beside me in the car. And, you know, I had an image of my guardian angel on my visor. So, as I said, I was going nowhere that night. I was well, I put it that I was protected from, I had good top cover, and then I had great ground cover from the soldiers as well in the barracks.
That day in April, you did that extraordinary thing in court where you went up and you hugged that young man and you said you forgave him. First of all, did you plan to do that?
I did. In my victim impact statement, I had a piece where obviously I was addressing the court, I was addressing the judge, but I had a part where I addressed him as well. And it's a bit awkward in the court because he was sitting at my 5 or 6 o'clock behind me. So I had to kind of turn to address him. And, you know, he showed remorse. He said, look, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. And did that in movement as well as in voice. There's always a risk in forgiveness. Like, forgiveness has to be accepted as well. You know, it's one thing saying, I can forgive you. But if somebody isn't sorry, then what does it mean? You know, so to me, the fact that he was able to say, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry, meant that that risk of forgiveness paid off. So afterwards, I returned to my seat in the court. And when the judge had finished and when the court was adjourned and the judge had left, I just saw an opportunity. I said to the guards, look, can I go and speak to him? I had said from the outset that I wanted to speak to him if he'd have me in the prison. But it wasn't suitable until, you know, the court had been held. So I said to him, I asked the guards and they checked with his counsel, they checked with his parents who were there, and they said, yeah, you can talk to him. So I went over to him and I just, you know, whispered into his ear a few things and embraced him in the hope that, you know, that the offer of forgiveness would change something. You know, you can fight hate with hate, and then we become entrenched in our hatred and we continue to hate one another. And I think there's enough of that going on in the world. St. John says that God is love. And if that's the case, love is stronger than hate. So I just believe that if I can fight hatred with love, well, then there's an opportunity for something different to happen. There's a different outcome. And, you know, my only hope and prayer is that that kid who was radicalised and so on, you know, that's a matter of, you know, it's accounted for in the court and so on, that he will have the opportunity and take the opportunity and use the opportunity and benefit from the opportunity of being de-radicalised and be able to return to society. You know, as I said to him, he's 17 now. He could have another 80 years on this earth. And that if he can do this for himself, it means that he can make a good, positive contribution to society for the rest of his life, rather than just being full of hatred. So it will benefit him. It will benefit the rest of the world too.
You also spoke to him after the sentencing. Did you say similar things?
I did. I just encouraged him once again. I mean, again, he was there. Like, I have no hatred in my heart. Do you know? Like, that does me no favours. So, no hatred in my heart. I just appealed to him to, you know, purify his heart to the point where he'd have no hatred either. You know, at some point, that kid will get out of detention, will return to society. If he can return a better person, well, that's a win.
Mm. Did it help you as well? Because you're incredible in relation to all of this. I think all of Ireland thinks you're an extraordinary human being, the kindness you have shown. But the fact that the judge and his lawyers laid out that he was on the autistic spectrum, that he had been radicalised, did that help you almost understand where he was coming from or how he did what he did?
There is an understanding, of course. And look, I've worked with children all my life in primary schools and secondary schools. You know, they're not quite children in the army, but you know what I mean, that they're young people. So yeah, understand lots of different things. It doesn't take away from the fact that an appalling crime happened. Mm. And you know, I said that to the judge on that day, that while I can personally forgive and I can have my heart pure of that, it doesn't take away from the fact that this has to be, there has to be a payment for this. Mm. There was an offence against the state, an offence against the defence forces, an offence against every soldier who walks through the gate of the barracks. So that price has to be paid. Mm. And, you know, to me, I wasn't out to say, oh, he has to be in prison for 20 years, 30 or 40 years, whatever. That doesn't matter to me. Once I know that that boy is a better person coming out than going in, well, then I'm happy with that.
You said to me on the way up to this studio, because I was saying how modest you were, and I know you're reluctant to do any interviews, that you found it extraordinary that people were so stunned that you, a man, a priest, had shown such compassion. And that, what does that say about our world? What did you mean by that?
What I mean is that that's our life. People have often said to me before, how do you forgive? How do you do this? And I just think that if you can work on the small things and try and get those right, well, then the big things, when they come along, take care of themselves. So I we preach forgiveness. I'm in the business of forgiveness. I hear confessions. I'm privileged to impart the forgiveness of Christ to other people. So to me, it's a really basic thing in life, to forgive. And listen, that doesn't take away from the hurt that people feel. You know, there are many other cases going on, I'm sure, in the court today where people just find it really, really difficult to forgive stuff. And in particular, when it's on behalf of others. So, you know, my son is killed. I can't forgive his killer, my wife, my whatever. It's very, very difficult, because you want to get justice for that person who's not around to do it for themselves. It's much easier, I think, for me, because it's me, I can do it more easily. But I do understand it's a difficult thing. But what I am surprised at is that there's been huge media attention, as I say, from around the world, and people want to make documentaries and people want all sorts of things. I'm just surprised that a bit of mercy and compassion is so extraordinary, or seems to be so, that it makes headlines, do you know? Mm-hmm. And maybe if we were a bit more forgiving in the world and a bit less harsh on others, we might just have a better world, do you know?
How are you now? You look great.
Thanks very much.
Are you well?
I am very well. I am. I have scars on my arms, which I am proud and honoured to have. They'll be with me all the days of my life. I'm very happy to have that, because I think that's a sign of love for the Defence Forces and for the people in it. I think, you know, I was honoured, as I say, to take those scars. I have, you know, a bit of loss of strength in my left arm and that. But, you know, I can do what I need to do. It's not the end of the world for me. I can get on with it. And I'm looking forward to, you know, just moving on from this. You know, there's a huge amount of publicity around it. It's not really for me. I don't really want to be on the cameras. I don't want to be talking, you know. It's a matter for me now just to get back to routine if I can. We have the International Military Pilgrimage to Lourdes is coming up soon. That I have that next. And then I just get back for 3 days from there, and I'm deployed to Lebanon then for 6 months. So I'll be there with our troops in the south of Lebanon, in that tragic area as well, and look forward to serving with the troops there.
Well, Father Paul Murphy, I think on behalf of everyone in this country, it's been a total privilege for me to speak to you today. Defence Forces Chaplain, thank you so much. And you're an extraordinary person.
Thank you so much.